Welcome to The Endless Spiral, a podcast dedicated to unraveling the intricate threads of mental health, exploring the profound depths of the human mind, and shedding light on the often turbulent journey towards well-being. In each episode, we embark on a thoughtful exploration of the challenges, triumphs, and evolving narratives surrounding mental health. Join me as we navigate the labyrinth of emotions, share personal stories, and engage in insightful conversations with experts, advocates, and individuals who have weathered their own storms. In this episode, I'm delighted to say that we are joined by eating distress coach Andrea Weldon. Andrea specializes in particular eating disorders and body image issues. She is also a business and life coach and is also the author of the book More Than a Mirror. I hope you enjoy this episode. So Andrea, thank you so much for taking the time to come on and talk to me on the Endless Spiral podcast. Obviously, I was saying in the intro, you're an eating disorder recovery coach who specializes in eating disorders and body image issues. So how are you at the moment? Anyway, before we kind of get into your own story and stuff, how are you at the moment?
I'm good. How are you?
I'm actually good. Not many people ask me, and I'm only joking. They kind of do. Or maybe I just edit that bit out. I can't remember. I'm actually all right.
I'm only pretending to care, Keith. You know, like, it's just a polite thing to say. If anyone's listening,
for people who are listening, myself and Andrea actually kind of know each other anyway, so you can, she's only joking. She really does care.
I don't really.
I know you don't. Fuck's sake. Oh, Christ almighty. Well, look, anyway, as I was saying before you decided to insult me, or did you? I probably didn't. I obviously, in this podcast, I've spoken to nutritionists and dietitians and psychotherapists and psychologists and all that type of stuff, but I have never really spoken to a life coach or on this podcast, and especially one like yourself who specializes in eating disorders and body image issues, which is obviously right down my street, because as you know, I have lived with both of them things for a long, long time. So we're going to use this episode as free therapy for me. So I hope you're all right with that.
I'll be sending you a bill now. I can't be doing that.
You probably will. Well, before we get into that, right, obviously you've got into that area for a reason. So will we go back to the beginning maybe, and we'll just kind of give people an insight into you and your own issues in the past with stuff.
Yeah. So I was 14 when I developed an eating disorder. And I will always say to people that it goes back an awful lot longer than that. But the behaviors themselves, and when I say behaviors, I'm referring to the actual food piece, the restricting piece, the getting sick piece, all of that stuff that started 14. But really the thinking was there a long time before that. You know, it was very much feeling very uncomfortable in my body, dissatisfied with my body, really not liking myself, comparing myself to everybody. So I spent a lot of time as a child in my head. So even though at, you know, it would technically have started at 14, I do think it was really kind of there for most of my life, to be honest. It just really got bad when I was 14. I lived with that for a very long time. I didn't say anything. I didn't know. Bear in mind, there was no internet or anything like that back then. So I didn't really understand what was happening. I had heard the term, but I didn't really understand it. But I am a very curious person, and I Google a lot of things now, but we didn't have Google back then. But I went off to the library and got myself a load of books out on psychology. That was literally at 14 years of age. I remember going over with my mom's library card to get psychology books out to see if I could kind of figure out what was wrong with me.
At 14, you went over to get psychology books. Jesus.
Yeah, that's it. Wow. Yeah. And I remember coming across then, you know, the term bulimia, and I was like, oh yeah, that sounds like that's what's wrong with me. But the description in the book, I remember it's still stamped in my head. It really didn't sit very well with me. There was a line in the book talking about how, like, people with bulimia, they want to have their cake and not eat it. And I was like, oh, and I remember even at 14 being like, I just don't really think that that's what it's about. And like, obviously now as an adult, I look back and I'm like, I really hated myself. I really hated my body. But it wasn't just about the body. It was myself as a person. I didn't like who I was. Self-esteem was shocking. And really what I was doing was I was using food as a way of managing my emotions. But then there was that piece, then if I lose weight, then people will like me better. But it was never about my body. It was about the fact that I didn't think people liked me anyway, without the body. So that's really pretty much, I didn't actually open up about my issue until I was 22. So it was very, very secret, very lonely place, very isolating place. And I think that's part of why I love doing the work that I do now, is because I know how lonely it is for people. People don't want to talk about it. There's a huge amount of shame about it. It's not as if you're going to be kind of having a cup of tea with somebody and probably telling them about it. So that, I think, is an important piece of the work for me, is to be able to hold a space for somebody who's gone through that and not judge it, and just maybe like fundamentally not make them feel, or not have them feel so lonely, to know.
Yeah, wow. It's just listening to you there, it just highlights for me even more the fact that I can resonate with so much of that. And it just shows that men and women can feel the exact same things. Because I know I'm always trying to maybe inspire men to open up a little bit more. But it just shows you like so much of what you're saying there. I'm like, yeah, just nodding away
Absolutely.
because. Like men and women feel all these things too. Do you know what I mean? It's like, and you said something there that is, and my stomach just sank. And I say the same thing. And like when I now understand the reaction I get from other people. Like you said to yourself, or so you said a second ago, I hated myself, and my stomach just sank. And I use that term as well because it's true. And the look I get from people when I say that. I now know what they feel when I say that because I felt it when you said it. I mean, and it's like you said, like it obviously happened, you know, that you're in your own head and the thoughts started a long time ago, which is obviously true for me as well because my problem started at 13, as you know, and I did what you did, you know, like you kind of you don't open up, you don't know. I didn't go to the library and get psychology books out at 14. I probably should have, but I didn't. But so much of what you said it resonates with me. It's amazing, isn't it, how men and women can just feel or can feel shame and stigma the same, really, isn't it?
And you've nailed it there, Keith. Like, there's no difference really between, like, if you have emotions, if you're a thinking, feeling human being, it doesn't matter whether you're a male, it doesn't matter whether you're a female or whatever. Like, once you feel emotions, you can have an eating disorder. And I really don't know where this idea came from, that it's a women's thing and that women study with body image issues. I do think that there is an awful lot of pressure, obviously, on women to look a particular way, and then obviously it's women who give birth and all that sort of stuff. So, they're expected to spring back into shape and, all that sort of stuff. There is probably that little bit more pressure, but at the same time, it really isn't about the body. It's about hate, and I think we all have the capacity to hate ourselves, and we all have the capacity to feel angry and take it out on ourselves. And to use food as a way of regulating emotions,
Yeah.
and gender really has nothing to do with that,
No, because we
so it's
spoke
really,
recently, didn't we? Sorry, go on.
yeah. No, go ahead.
No, I was just going to say, because remember we spoke recently and we were saying kind of the food is a byproduct of it. It's there's obviously trauma or there's something behind that, isn't there? You know? But you like so you started feeling these things at 14, but you said you went and got these books out, so you kind of you were proactive with it fairly straight away, or no? Like, I mean, obviously, you didn't speak about it till your 20s, but.
I'd say I'm a very curious person, so I think I need to know what's going on. I need to, have the answers. I'm one of these people that when I'm sitting watching a program, I need to know what other person or program that person was in, that actor was in. I need to know
I do
now,
that too, yeah.
So, I think that the checking out the books was just to kind of, I just needed to have the answers of what is it? Is it definable? Is it something that other people have as well? But I wouldn't say I was proactive with it because I kept it very much a secret. And then, unfortunately, what happened when the internet did become a thing, I was using that in a very, very destructive way. So rather than using that to help myself and to figure out, tips that could support me or any of those things, I was actually using it in a very, very toxic way, and using it to, really sort of spur on the eating disorder. And I was looking for very toxic tips. But look, we're talking about a time when I used to have to go to internet cafes to with my can of Diet Coke, of course, to the internet cafe and sit there and look up these really kind of toxic things. And then it became available on, that we all had an internet at home, and then we all had it on our phones and everything like that as well. So unfortunately, that was another rabbit hole that I went down. So I wouldn't say I was proactive. I'd say I was actually quite destructive with the information that I was getting. And that is one of the dangers of information, is that, and it's something I'm always very careful of, I never share things about weight, what I was eating, what I wasn't eating, the behaviors that I did. I never share those particular details, because actually you're very much in danger of giving somebody an idea, because when somebody is on a self-destructive mission, and that's what I was on, you're going to look for every single resource to help with that, So I'm always very, very careful with that.
Jesus, yeah. Because I get asked a lot of the time, and because obviously I done nothing with it for a lot. Well, I didn't open up for a long time, and I've basically done the opposite. You nearly, I hid away and I buried my head in the sand. But then when people say to me, "Well, what when I was kind of got the body dysmorphia diagnosis and stuff, and they're like, "Well, what did you do with the information?" And this is what you're saying: you can be either pro or not. You can be proactive, but you can be negative with it, or you can be destructive with it, or active with it, or destructive with it. Now, luckily for me, I was proactive with the information I got. I used the information I got to find help and to find a solution. But obviously, as you said, you can completely go completely the other way, and because of I was the same. Obviously, if we had had internet when I was younger, God knows what I would have done or found. Because when you're in your own head, you're bad enough with the negative mindset you have without going online. Then, if you had it and trying to find more information to basically justify the hatred you have for yourself,
Yeah.
Well, like, are you comfortable saying, like, what were you telling yourself when you said you hated yourself or the hatred for yourself? Well, like, what type of things were you telling yourself?
I don't know even if it was necessarily something that I was telling myself. I mean, there was obviously that, like, I'm a bad person, I'm a bad friend, I'm a bad, at the time, girlfriend, or fiance later on, those kind of things probably. But I think it was more of a feeling. When I look back, it was just this massive discomfort, this awkwardness in myself and in my body. And I was only sharing this with a group of people yesterday. I'd actually kind of forgotten about it. I used to even think about how I walked. I was are my arms looking real weird while I'm
I did that
like,
too.
and yeah, like, it, and it literally only popped into my head yesterday. I was like, God, I totally forgot. And it actually took me aback when it came to me. But I was thinking, God, I used to like really think about every single movement in my body. And if I was standing there, do I look really awkward? Because I feel really awkward. And are they thinking that I look really awkward? And it was just this feeling, So that's the way, yes, I was giving myself a negative narrative. I'm not good enough, I'm not thin enough, people will like me if I'm better. But I have to say, it was more the feeling. A real feeling of discomfort inside of my body, that drove it. But you can
Do you think
relate.
you had? Yeah, tell me about it. I could, like, I didn't like my shadow, for example. I think I told you that before. Like, look down at the silhouette in the ground. I'm like, it's all irrational, the stuff that you tell yourself to try and justify these feeling negative feelings you have inside yourself. It's just crazy. Do you think you kind of lived with body dysmorphia for a while?
Yeah, I personally, I it's interesting that you're bringing up the labels. I personally, I'm not a massive fan of labels. I think, and the reason why is, I think sometimes we, and obviously I can't speak for you, but I when I say we, I'm talking about I think it definitely is something that at times would have leaned into. So I remember going to the doctors and getting diagnosed as, to be honest, she didn't really know what to do with me. So she kind of diagnosed me as anorexia slash bulimia, which really, or anorexic slash bulimic, which really annoyed me, because I was like, well, which one is it? Like, I wanted to be anorexic. That's the diagnosis that I wanted to have. And then there I was with the two, and they're kind of conflicting as well. And that really annoyed me. So then when you're saying body dysmorphia, I'm like, yeah, like, absolutely. Like, I mean, what I was seeing in the mirror was not, the reality at all. But I find sometimes with diagnosis, and I know the minute I was diagnosed, I start leaning into it more and using it as an excuse That it's like, yeah, but that's just because I have this. That's just because that's what anorexic people do. That's because that's like the pattern. And so then I wasn't really kind of doing anything to help myself. And that's the way my mind was operating. So it never really helped me to have a label. But I do understand that some people I work with, it really helps them to understand themselves and to understand that there's other people and there is a name for it, but definitely in my case, it was never something that I found helpful because I definitely would have used that as a get out clause,
Yeah, I think if I had had labels or diagnosis when I was younger, I definitely would have leaned into them. I'm in a different headspace now, and I used the labels, not necessarily to have a label. It's not that at all for me. It was once I knew there was a condition or a term for what I had, I knew, well, if there was a term for it, there must be help for. So it wasn't just how I was, well, it was just how I was feeling, but there was something behind it. And those other people like me, so I wasn't. I was. I didn't. I was nearly. I used that, so I couldn't lean into it. If you know what I mean, thinking, well, okay, there's lots of other people who live like this as well. So it's not just me. I'm not unique. I'm not just me. There's other people that feel like this. So if there's other people that feel like this, then maybe they can help, or I can help, or we can chat, and then all of a sudden they can open up about it, and obviously the onion starts to unravel then. So I used it for a completely different way, but I completely know what you mean. If I had had that when I was younger, I probably would have used it because I was in that headspace of, well, I probably could have used it as an excuse where I had done a lot of work on myself and I'd been in therapy for a while anyway. So I was more open to getting that information and being able to use it a bit better, productively rather than negatively.
And it's really lovely to hear that, like, the kind of the different ways that we were thinking. And that is how I work with people. I always ask them, like, what do you call it? What do how do you define it? Do you use the term eating disorder? Do you use the term eating distress? Do you use the term, because some people, I've heard a lot of people in media call, in sessions call it Anna, when it's anorexia. Like, so I'm like, what do you, you've never, you look like you've never heard that. No.
No.
But it is actually really common, so I will always ask, like, what do you call it? Because I mean, that's part of, I'm thrown in the coaching piece now, but it's very much like, let me into your world and what it's like for you and the way you see things. It's not about what I think, it's about what you think, So I always ask that question, like, what way do you want me to refer to this with you? And some people love the label, and that's absolutely okay because it just gives them that, this is what we're working on. It's very concrete. And, the idea of recovery is to be without that label, And some people don't want to go near that label. They don't like it. They don't like the connotations. It's not helpful for them. So loads of people have lots of different names for the diagnosis, which is really interesting. But I always ask.
When the term was said to me and I got kind of diagnosed with it, for me it was more validation that I was, I was able to validate my feelings a bit more. And like I said, I was able to use it in a productive way. But what happened in your 20s then when you opened? Because obviously I didn't open up about this much later. What happened in your 20s when you started to open up about it? How did that come about?
Yeah, that's an interesting thing. I think it was like a part of me just was so struggling with it. It came out by accident, but obviously, like an accident, it was probably the subconscious mind just, allowing something to come out. So I went to the doctor about something unrelated and basically just burst into tears and was like, this is what's been happening. But obviously that I was ready, and that probably pretty much went on for most of my 20s. There was a part of me going online and looking up destructive information, doing very, very destructive things, being extremely mean to my body and extremely cruel to my body. But then there was a part of me showing up every single week and going to groups and going to sessions and, really, really wanted to recover and really wanted to help people and, really wanted to be on the other side of it. So it was a massive conflict because it was like there was two of me, but working in different directions. So I would love to say, and then I opened up about it, and then everything was all happy ever after, but it didn't really go that smoothly, because it was very much a lot of years of which wolf are we feeding here, because both of them were just going in totally different directions, and one was so motivated, and the more motivated that piece became, the more destructive the other side became. So that was a really
Wow.
interesting, yeah. So it took a massive amount of I did a lot of mindset work at that time, very much how to override your negative thoughts and your negative voice, and try and focus on the positives. And I think that's absolutely great to a degree, and I think that can get you so far. But then you have to drop down and be like, okay, but like, feelings wise, what is it that you can't cope with in your body? And that's definitely, when I think of the core of it, was like, I can't deal with anger, sadness, any emotion, even sometimes happiness. So I was like, oh my God, I'm too happy, it's going to be taken away. So it was
Yeah.
really kind of taking it back down. So it's a lot of work, and I'd love to turn around and say, that it was real quick, but I had left it so long as well. It took such a long time because I had left it so long to open up about it. So if anybody is listening and is on the fence about whether to open up about it, I would say please don't leave it as long, because it won't just go away. I waited for it to go away. I kept thinking, I'll grow out of it when I get to like in my 20s, I'll grow out of it. And obviously that doesn't happen. You can probably relate to that.
Yeah, it doesn't happen overnight. I think we
No.
obviously spoke on you recently. I had a little bit of a relapse re recently as well, and it just doesn't. It's hard to change a mindset that you've lived with for a long, long time, no matter how much you want to change it. Now, you have to want to change it, obviously,
True. Yeah.
but sometimes you do slip back in to things, or things will trigger you and stuff. Like, what would trigger you? Like, so I'll give my example. I know I told you the other day, but my little kind of relapse last week was I went to a restaurant, and well, it was more like a wine bar. So, and I just thought we were going for wine, and I didn't realize that we were going to be getting food, and I wasn't prepared for food, and then I felt a bit pressured to choose the food, to enjoy the food. I had an injured back, so my mood wasn't great anyway. And then they put me in this, our host in a seat, and it was right in the middle of the place, and I just felt very vulnerable and open. And a lot of these things, and this, it's you know, my mood dropped. And once you get into that mindset, it's very hard to just get out of that mindset. You can't just flick a switch and go, oh, I don't feel like that anymore. It's very hard. Like, what would have been your triggers?
I'd very much relate it back to emotions. It was interesting hearing you speaking there, because you mentioned the word vulnerable, that you were in that situation and it started with the food, but then you were in the middle of it. And actually, I could nearly feel that panic when it was thinking of what you were saying there. You were in the middle, and then, there's all these people around you and you felt vulnerable. So I would say, okay, so the feelings there, like if I was reflecting that back to you, there was a feeling of vulnerability. It wasn't so much about the food, but it was what was going on emotionally for you. And I really see triggers as information, that if you're being triggered, and like we're always, we all have a past, we all have stuff, we all have childhood stuff and teenage stuff and relationship stuff and all that. And if you get triggered, and look, I think we all get triggered all the time by different things. It could be a noise, it can be a smell, it can be something somebody says. That's information of something that maybe I haven't worked on yet, that I maybe didn't even know about. Like that, maybe you get to a certain point in the process and you think, actually, I've got loads done here. And then something comes up and you're like, oh, that really took me back. I didn't expect that. And I'm like, yeah, but that's just information. It's just a little piece of work that maybe you haven't healed yet. So it's interesting, even hearing you calling it a relapse, because I don't know if I look at it the same way when maybe people that I'm working with, they have a little moment. I'm like, okay, it was a lapse, because something wasn't ironed out, and take I think that the whole pandemic is a really good example of it. You can do so much work on yourself, and you can be so prepared and so like able to sit in these environments and sit with food and sit in social situations. You could have never prepared yourself for a global pandemic and all the things shutting down and all the bizarreness that went with it. You could have never done that work because you didn't see it coming. So most people weren't equipped to deal with it because they've recovered for the world that was, and then all of a sudden there was this world that was just completely different. So that definitely may have thrown an awful lot of people. So that's just like an example of it. But then I would say that's just an area that didn't get any attention, do you know?
Yeah. So obviously, I'd say this, I'm not the only person who will have a moment, let's not call it a relapse then. I
It's
mean, when I go.
your language. You can call it what you want to call it.
Yeah, well,
But
I take your point actually, and obviously a lot of people listening might not like that word either, so let's maybe just call it a vulnerable moment or whatever that we want to call it. So what would you have said to me when that happens? As in, I say you're sitting beside me, because I'm just gonna bring you everywhere in just case it happens. So let's just assume you're sitting right there beside me.
As long as
Or
you're going
pick
to
up.
pay, as long as you're going to pay for my food,
Yeah. Say I pick up
you
the phone. I have a phone a friend
know.
option, right? And I ring you
Yeah.
and I tell you how I'm feeling. What advice would you give? What advice would you have given to me then? You need more information, obviously. I get that.
Yeah, well, probably the first question that I would ask is, what are you feeling? That's the first question that popped into my head is, what is the predominant feeling that you're finding, extremely difficult to deal with? And then I would probably check in and say, have you had this feeling before? Like this feeling of, can I ask that? Have you had that feeling before?
Have I had that feel? Oh yeah, lots of times. Yeah, Jesus,
Yeah,
like
yeah.
hundreds of times. Yeah,
And
yeah,
like in a situation like that, I might say, and has anything helped you to overcome that feeling before?
yeah.
Putting you on the
I don't.
spot now.
I don't actually know, to be honest. Well, since I've right here we go. So since I've started to put a lot of work into myself, I haven't really had that feeling much in because in that setting. I've had that feeling sometimes, maybe, but not in that setting, right? That's kind of the first time I've had that feeling in that setting, in where, because I wasn't prepared, I wasn't ready, my back was. So there's a lot of things going on that were kind of unusual as well. I'd never been to this place before. The seating was a bit unusual. I was with someone who is very passionate about food, very passionate about wine. I felt pressure to really enjoy it for them, and that was a lot of pressure from me as well, because I was not only feeling overwhelmed with the other stuff, I was also feeling pressure to, I can't say anything, I can't look like I'm not enjoying this, I can't look like I'm upset, because that will ruin their night. And there's a lot of stuff going on in my head. So with all of that going on, I hadn't felt like that in a long time, so I didn't know what to do with it. I didn't know how to process my feelings.
Yeah, so what I'm ultimately hearing is you're really taken aback because you hadn't felt like that in such a long time, that you had done this level of work on yourself, and then all of a sudden it was like you were back here in this kind of moment that you haven't experienced in a long time. And you mentioned so many things there that, that your back was at you, and that the seating was a bit unusual, and you had all this pressure. And that obviously was a really hard situation for you to be in, So the thing that I would probably, if I was sitting with you there, was like, what do you actually need right now in that situation to be okay?
I needed to probably share how I was feeling with the other person to take the pressure off things and explain to them, because I could see that they were getting a bit uneasy because they could see that I was uneasy and I wasn't really telling them what was wrong. So I probably really needed to, excuse me, now we had a conversation after it, but I needed to have a conversation with them there and then and explain to them so they understood a bit more of how I was feeling,
So you see there, like you do have the answers yourself, but you the narrative inside your head that you can't share or whatever, and then afterwards you did share, and it obviously was really, really helpful. And I think, look, again, that's learning then for when you, if you ever do feel like you're in that situation again, that you'll remember that actually, no, I'm not going to sit here on my own and just, feel all this pressure. I'm going to share it, just because actually it does really help when we talk things out, when we get it outside of our head, and it helps to kind of alleviate the feeling and the noise inside the head as well, because it just keeps spinning around and around,
Because when I kind of vaguely gave you that story previously, and you were saying obviously, like just maybe to just focus on maybe the other person or focus on my senses a bit more. just to get myself, try and get myself out of that headspace, not to smell the food, look at the food, or you know, that isn't, that's what you said, wasn't it? Just to
Yeah, I
kind of
would say
change your
that, yeah,
mindset a little
usually,
bit.
because, yeah, we can go into our senses and our heads a little bit when we're in that. We're like, look at the, like the seating's not right and my back is sore and everybody's coming in the door and there's a draft and it's noisy and we can definitely focus on all that, and it's a bit of sensory overload sometimes. So even like such a small thing, like just feel your back against the back of the chair, if there was a back on the chair, you know, and feel, you know, your bum sitting on the bottom of the chair and your feet on the ground, and what does it feel like, you know, and just kind of even planting yourself into the ground for a second can help to, you know, with that sensory overload. And it is something that, like, you know, grounding exercise, like I would ground myself quite a lot because I get very if t and this did happen the other day, two people were talking to me at the same time. At the same, and my head, I thought my head was going to blow up. And, you know, I find that really hard to deal with when two people are speaking to me at the same time. I'm like, I have one brain. I can't process what two people are saying at the same time. And like, I really have to take a breath there, you know, so that I don't react. I really have to take a breath because my nervous system goes into overdrive. So I just sometimes have to take a breath and I'm like, okay, it's you're fine. You're fine. You know, feel yourself sitting in the chair, feel your feet on the ground, you're okay. So even reminding yourself that you're okay as well, and that if you have felt like that before, you've obviously gotten through it, so that you will. So that little bit of reassurance, but we can go into panic mode, you know,
This was your fight or
from
flight kicking in, isn't it?
absolutely, yeah. And even noticing when that happens as well, you know, because one of my go-tos would be a little bit of a breath hold or a lot of a breath hold, you know, if I go into fight or flight. So even noticing, okay, I'm holding my breath, you know, and breathe, because if you don't breathe, your whole body is just going to go into absolute adrenaline overload, and it's going to be extremely hard to cope. So there's so many things, you know, but ultimately you named it there for you. It was sharing the experience and not being alone with it.
And the thing is that because I shared it with that person afterwards, we had a conversation, they were able to understand where I was coming from more. It took the pressure off things. But the best part about it was we were able to put in not precautions, but we were able to put in little boundaries and or a little plan before we go somewhere the next time, just so I know a little more. Just for the time being, I'm working on things. I don't want to be like this. I want to get to that place where I can go to these places and enjoy it and all that type of stuff. I want to get there. But just in the meantime, we were able to put a little plan in place saying, look, I just probably at the moment, and it was you who suggested this to me, you just need to have a little plan. So maybe I need to know if we are going to have food. What type of food are we going to have? Is the food going to be the focus of the social event? So I remember I was saying to you that there was another one coming up where I was going to be going and meeting people, and there would be food there. And I was saying to you, well, I think I'd be okay with that because the food isn't the focus. Meeting the people is the reason I'm going to be there. So my focus isn't really on the food. But if we're going for somewhere and I know the other person has a real passion for food and they really want to be there to enjoy the food, I just need to. They need to know in advance that, you know, I'm not I might not be going there to enjoy the food just yet, but I want to be there to spend time with them. But also, I need to have an out maybe saying, look, if it gets a bit overwhelming, I need to walk away for a few minutes or something. We were able to put in a plan, and it took all the pressure off things. So I then know if
There you
I
go.
go somewhere and I start to feel overwhelmed, I can just say to them, and they'll understand.
Yeah, so that's really interesting to hear that, you know, you had that clarity, and then the expectations then, you know, that you have are different than what that person has, and that when you're clear on the expectations that hers is going to be different than yours, that it's easier, and that your focus is not the food, you're not there yet, you know, so you know your level, you know what you're capable of as well, which, you know, sounds like in the last scenario, it just was beyond what you were capable of in that moment. So it's interesting to hear you say when you share it, you can come up with that plan and it can be safer for you the next time, you know.
And I even suggested to that person that we go back to that place again. I want, you know, to not face my fears, but basically, as you said to me before, is to replace the negative memories with positive ones. So I don't want, She really likes that place, and I don't want the lasting
A lot
memory.
of wise things that I don't remember saying. I'm sitting here and I'm like, did I say that?
Maybe I'm paraphrasing. Maybe it's all just my maybe it's all just my
Oh no, I
amazing
definitely
mind
said it. I
working.
said
Yeah,
it.
you definitely did. You definitely did. But like just to replace the positive with the next, I don't want the lasting memory to be a negative, negative feeling left on that. I want to go back, and I want to be able to be there for the right reasons. But we'll get there eventually. But back to you, right? So when did you kind of discover you wanted to help people?
I knew. I remember coming out of a session one day, and I remember thinking, I am going to be in that chair one day. I just knew. I don't know what. I think it was always there in me, and I always joke about this. I think I was 15, and I was telling people that I wanted to be a psychiatrist, and I had no idea what a psychiatrist was, and I actually really wouldn't want to be a psychiatrist, but back then I thought I wanted to be, and I think I always knew I wanted to help people, and I suppose, look, I would analyze that a bit and say in wanting to help other people, I probably actually wanted to help myself. But then I suppose eating disorders are so misunderstood. They're so lonely. There's a lot of judgment around them. There's a lot of shame around them. And I love that I can hold that space for somebody where they don't feel judged, and they don't feel and they know that I've the experience personally as well, which can be really helpful for people too. And it's not about my story. It's not. It's about them. But I think it just helps them to be like, oh, this is a safe place to open up. But I always knew, and it definitely motivated me, on my journey, because I was like, well, I can't do this work until I actually get there. I can't, I'm gonna have to push myself here. So it definitely helped shift my mindset to go back to that piece that it was like there is hope, and you can design your future, and you can do work that you really enjoy. So that it was always in me, always in me, and I think it always will be. I really want to. I can never see myself not working in this area. It's something that I'm. It sounds so cliche, but it's like it's such lovely work, and I love it. And I love all aspects of it, and whether it's sitting one to one with a person, whether it's working with a family, whether it's delivering content to educate people, whether it's helping out a colleague or something with a question, whether it's sharing my experience, whatever it is, I absolutely love it. And it is such a privilege, and it probably sounds very cliche, but it's such a privilege to do it.
Yeah, it's great to see someone who's found their passion for something and just embrace it fully, because I know you have a massive passion for it, and I think it's incredible. What's the so you're like a so you're a life coach basically, but you specialize in eating disorders and body image issues. Well, what's the difference, if you might not be able to explain it, but what's the difference between a coach and a therapist?
So coaching is more about present future, so it's this is what's happening now, and you want to get here. So how can we get that? That sums it up really, really quickly. So it's like a lot of people come to coaching because they're stuck. They're feeling stuck. They maybe have a lot of information. Therapy, a lot of the time, will go backwards, So it will kind of go back into the past and maybe look at the roots of stuff and why it happened. And it's very, very deep work. So often what a lot of people say to me is they have went to years of therapy, and they know so much about themselves, and they know the why, and they know why all this is happening, but they just practically sometimes get stuck. Yeah, but how do I get rid of the behaviors now? So that's kind of where I can step in there and really look at that kind of forward moving piece. So there is a difference, for sure. And then I suppose my work is different again. In the eating disorders work is kind of like nearly different again. The eating disorder skills, I worked in that for a very, very long time, and in that area. And then I trained as a coach, and to be honest, I didn't really understand any of the differences, I think, initially. I didn't exactly know what coaching was when I went off to train as a coach, and I was absolutely blown away by the impact of coaching, and how it really gets people pushing outside of their comfort zone and overcoming obstacles and blocks and moving forward. And I remember thinking, right, okay, I really like this. How am I going to merge the two? How am I going to use the skills that I already have, but kind of wrap it up in that kind of coaching model? And that is the way that I work now. I am hugely passionate about coaching. I think it's absolutely phenomenal. Really, really powerful. I think a lot of the stuff that I do in my own life now as a result is a result of having been coached myself. I see so many people doing amazing things. And again, it's not to it can all sound very kind of wishy-washy. Don't get me wrong, therapy is fantastic as well, but I think there's a place for both, depending on what somebody some what's going on. But practically speaking, the coaching gives you that like degree of accountability. You've kind of maybe somebody you're holding yourself accountable to somebody. So when you're saying you're going to do something, and like a perfect example of it would be somebody said something the other day about I'm going to reflect on that, and then it was like, okay, the question there was like, what does that look like? How are you going to reflect on it? How are you going to, so it's very much like getting that clarity and then maybe coming back and saying, okay, they might text me in between a session or email me in between a session and say, okay, I did this and this was the learnings from it as well. So there is that accountability piece as well. So it's a brilliant area, and I love the mix of the both because it's great in helping people to overcome those behaviors.
Accountability was the word I had in my head when you were talking, because that just sounds exactly what it is. And some people really need that, because you can get very overwhelmed. You can procrastinate about so many things, and you can have all the wanting to do something as much as you like. But sometimes, and everyone's different, some people have it and some people don't, and some people just need a bit of accountability, to just push them on a little bit more. Would you find that your clients would be more female than men, or half and half, or how's it work for you?
For me, because I see people for business coaching and life coaching and general, stuff and the eating disorder stuff, I've a really, really even mix at the moment. But I would say that most of the people that are coming to me for the eating disorder stuff are female. And I actually feel quite sad about that because I know that there's actually a lot of men that are really struggling and they won't go. And I've had, and it's really interesting the way men approach me a lot of the times. They call me and they say, yeah, no, like I just have a few bits and pieces going on. Like I don't have an eating disorder or anything like that, and they're very, very much making me understand that they don't, and then it will transpire that they do, but there's an awful lot of shame around it. As a man saying it seems to be really hard to admit it. And I think that's the fault of media, because they tend to use women. And I know you've done an awful lot of media and you're speaking on behalf of males, but like we look at magazines and it's always, and it's so annoying. It's always girls, it's always like 16-year-old girls, and it's the picture of them kind of in the hospital, very, very underweight body. And that is such a misrepresentation of what an eating disorder actually is. An eating disorder, it comes, it's any gender, any religion, any age. I mean, you can be 70 with an eating disorder and you can be 10, and so this idea that it's a female in a hospital with a drip up their nose is so wrong to know. So I do blame the media on that one, and that's obviously goes back to selling newspapers and magazines,
Yeah, I've been saying that for ages, and it's a common misconception, isn't it? Like, it's just the stereotypical image of someone with an eating disorder is usually an adolescent girl, very thin, malnourished, all that type of stuff. And I think, like, I was speaking yesterday to a binge eating disorder therapist. I've had her on the podcast before. She was on again yesterday, and we were just talking about that. It's like, even to be diagnosed with a binge eating disorder, there's so much criteria that most people won't meet because it's just not well known enough, or there's not enough information about it. And I think that's why so many people maybe were interested in my story, because they're kind of like, I don't look like the stereotypical person who would have body image issues or an unhealthy relationship with food, because I look perfectly healthy.
Can I come in on that, Keith? Would that be okay? Can I jump in there and interrupt you? Anybody that walks through my door, generally speaking, will look like they don't have an eating disorder. Now, there obviously are, there's obviously going to be the, but most people don't. And I can't know by looking at somebody whether they do or they don't. And that's where the media really have done a real disservice there, because most people actually look absolutely fine. You can't tell. And you see, the media will use people with anorexia to shock value of it. But even when I say that, not everybody that has anorexia is actually that low weight, And that's where there's so much confusion. People think anorexia has to be somebody that's, very, very, very underweight. Not necessarily. There's so many other factors there. So
Yeah, good
sorry for
point.
interrupting, but I had to say that
No,
big
it's
point before.
yeah, no, it's a very valid point, to be honest. And that, yeah, I'm glad you said that, because it is, it's a media thing, as you said, the shock value. But you also mentioned education a little while ago, and I think that just leaves me perfectly on, because I wanted to talk to you about that. So you do a lot of talks in schools and stuff, and you're always trying to educate people. Like, how important is it to educate children as well?
Yeah, and with children, I wouldn't be going near the topic of eating disorders, and I would argue that they don't need to hear that, and that they're too young and all that sort of stuff. But then they are seeing an awful lot of stuff online, unfortunately, which, is a tough one. But I very much, when I'm educating children, and I do talks in primary schools, so they'll be quite young children. Very much about the body image, very much about how you don't have to change yourself, and that if you're changing your body in order to feel better, that that's not the solution. That's how do you feel better without having to do these kind of self-destructive things to your body, without having to change yourself. So a lot about self-acceptance, a lot about maybe challenging your negative thoughts, because just because you have a thought doesn't necessarily mean it's true, or just because somebody says something mean to you doesn't mean that it's true. And then that capacity to be able to hold your feelings as well, because a lot of feelings, it was like when I mentioned the sensory overload there earlier on, when we get feelings, sometimes they're massive, they're really hard to cope with. So like if you take a feeling of like sadness or anger, for example, a child will probably feel that in their stomach, and it can feel like a heavy pit inside their stomach. And like when you think about it from a child's point of view, like how do I make that go away? Oh, well, I heard on TikTok, or I saw on TikTok, that their stomach felt better when they didn't eat the lunch or whatever like that. So it's very simplistic for a child. Unfortunately, they're scrambling around trying to find a solution to feel better, and they've heard a lot of people around them, maybe on diets, like parents, aunts, uncles, all that sort of stuff, saying things like, "Oh, I feel so much better in myself now." These flippant comments since I started eating salad for lunch, I feel so much better. And a child will just take that information and they'll run with it, because that's the way children think. So often talk about what we're hearing at home and all that sort of stuff, and how that's not, but I think that the term self-acceptance is the biggest thing. Like that it's like, this is the body, this is the hair color, this is the skin, this is the whatever. And a lot of work around the positive mindset as well. What is good about me? What is good about my body? What is my body used for? Because we're used to seeing on social media how, and unfortunately, 11-year-olds, 10-year-olds are being exposed to this, that your thighs are too wobbly and that you should have a thigh gap, and you should be able to see your hip bones. And it's really, I'm actually trying to stop myself from getting angry thinking about what they're seeing. But the way I would reframe that is, but what's great about my body? What is great about what my body does? Like that my body is a vessel that helps me to play sport and to helps me to run to my friend's house and all of these things. So to try and not just have this physical, visual part, but also to My body is this capable machine that actually allows me to feel these amazing experiences and do these amazing things and have these amazing experiences. So a lot of in-depth stuff, but nothing to do with eating disorders, you know?
Yeah, brilliant. Yeah. Would you have ever get a parent coming to you, obviously, talk about their child, and then would, if the child agrees, or would they then bring the child to you, or would you coach the parent as well, or how would that dynamic work?
Yeah, depending on the age of the child, I would coach the parent. So, if you're talking about like a very young child, you'd be working with the parents. And then if it's teenagers, I would blend both. And then even when it's adults, a lot of the time, if they can have support with them, if they are living with their parents, it's really great to get them involved. Because it's one thing that it's such a complex topic, and parents are in danger of saying the wrong things and getting it wrong, and they're trying to motivate and they don't understand it. So as much as possible, I would always try and have the parents involved anyway, regardless of somebody's age and if they're living in that environment. But for a very young child, it would be working with the parents.
Okay. Would you, is there anything in particular that you would say to a parent if they were worrying about their child having body image issues? Is there anything that they could look out for? Or I know everyone is different, but like pulling at their clothes or anything like, is there anything that like, kind of that they should look out for?
Yeah, you named one there, like pulling at the clothes, spending excessive amounts of time in front of the mirror, just sounding like they're uncomfortable in their body, maybe making references to their body and other people's. I'd be very much looking out for things like, I'm not eating sugar today. Okay, what's the rationale behind that? Because like kids go through fate, you can't assume everything is going to turn into, but it's like, what's your logic here? What do you hear? And what is it about the sugar that, and sometimes it could be really simple. I know my daughter, she said something along the lines of, just sometimes when you're after having so much chocolate, over Christmas or whatever, your head just feels all blurry or something like that, and I was like, okay, yeah, so that's okay. But if it's kind of because I'm feel like I'm bad because I've eaten too much sugar, I'd be definitely if they're starting to kind of maybe I've eaten already and not eaten their dinners and disappearing to the bathroom after dinner is always one to be looking out for as well, and getting clarity on, because some people just need to go to the bathroom after dinner and that's okay, but getting clarity on that. But I would always say to a parent, trust your gut. You know when there's something not right with your child. When they're starting to dance a little bit differently than they normally are. When things are not quite right. When their language is starting to change. Maybe their mood is starting to change. You can tell when a child is uncomfortable in themselves. You can tell when they're trying to, they're obsessed with fitting in and maybe thinking that people are not liking them. That they're hiding the way a child would even carry themselves when they're walking. They don't want to be seen. They don't look confident. But the biggest thing is intuition. As a parent, you just know. You know when there's something wrong. You might not be able to name what it is, but you know something's off. So if you spot it, there's probably something there,
Yeah, brilliant. While we're on that subject of children and education, for anyone listening, Andrea wrote a book. It's called More Than a Mirror, and it's aimed towards, well, I'll obviously let you explain it, but it's aimed towards children. And it's my three kids have it. It's like a workbook, and it's all about kind of accepting their body and being positive in their body and in themselves. And it's brilliant. My kids love it. Andrea, do you want to give people a little bit of an insight into kind of why you created that and the response you've had from it?
No, the response has been great. To be honest, Keith, it was an accident. Like the book, I didn't sit down one day and was like, I'm going to write this kid's book on body image. What happened was someone had messaged me through Instagram and had asked, do you have any like resources for parents, like worksheets and stuff like that? And I was like, well, look, I can put them together. And I love creativity. I love, visuals and all that sort of stuff. So I was putting them together and I couldn't stop. I had so many ideas and so many things were coming to me, and I'd be kind of waking up at 5 o'clock in the morning, be like, oh my God, I just had an idea. And there was so much there. And then all of a sudden, I just had pages and pages and pages. And I think, actually, don't know how many pages the book is. Is it 40? I'm not sure how many pages it is. It's terrible, isn't it? I have no idea. But I know there was a lot more. And I ended up having to take some out, or otherwise it would have cost about €50 to print it, But yeah, it was really just a resource to help parents. And the idea behind it really is to not just to give it to your child and say, off you go and do that, but to sit down and open up discussions. Because sometimes parents don't know where to start. They're like, how do I kind of do this? How do I even approach it? So it was kind of the idea of like, here's a visual and here's this little character, Alf, and his story about how he is in his body. How do you feel about your body? Like, would you want to change yours, or do you think that's silly, or do you know? So really, just to be able to open up that conversation in a real safe, non-intrusive way.
Yeah, it's brilliant. Like I said, my kids have. I put a picture up on Instagram one day of my two daughters at the kitchen counter, and they both have
Yeah.
the in front of them, and they're filling it in, and they still have it up beside their beds. They do. They honestly do. And I'm not kidding you guys. It's brilliant. It really is so good. And of course, it's coming from Andrea, whose life experience. You're also a parent. It's really good. If just go into Amazon and just type in "More Than a Mirror," you'll get a link for it there. You probably can get it on your website as well, can you?
Yeah, there is a link to it on the website, yeah, and Instagram. Yeah. I'm delighted to hear that. That's all I want to hear. And it's so lovely to hear that kids are maybe getting these kind of positive messages. And that's really all it was about, just plant a few seeds, because everything is telling you you're not good enough. So it was just something to kind of come along and challenge that idea. It's a small thing, but
It's not a small thing at all. It's brilliant. It's something that it's just so important for children to have. I think we've probably covered loads today.
did.
Unless there's anything else you want to add, Andrea. Is there anything else you want to talk about?
No, I think I'm probably talked out, which is unusual. I have an awful lot to say, but I can't think of anything else. No, it's a lovely conversation. And yeah, it's very interesting just hearing, your experience versus my experience. And there's no right way to recover, and there's no right way to have an experience. Your experience is unique, your recovery journey is going to be unique, and you can see the differences and similarities as we're talking. And if anybody is listening or thinking, oh well, maybe I don't have those issues because it's not the same, it doesn't have to be the same. So trust yourself. If something doesn't feel right, it's not right,
Yeah, and as I always say, and you said at the very beginning of this podcast, a body image struggles, eating disorder struggles. There's no gender involved in this. There's no age.
No.
There's none. It's like if this is gonna can affect everyone at any age, and it's never too late to seek help. Trust me,
No.
I've lived with it for 30 years. It's never too late. Honest to God, it isn't. Andrea, where can people contact you?
So the website is andreaweldon.ie, and then like there on Instagram and Facebook and all that sort of stuff. Haven't got myself a TikTok yet. I'm not there yet.
Okay, brilliant. Yeah, right, guys. I think we'll probably leave that there. I think we've covered enough. Thank you so much, Andrea, for giving up your time to chat to me today. Insightful as ever.
Thank you for having me, and lovely to chat as always.
Yeah, very welcome. And I'll send you a blank check later on. Right, guys, we'll leave that there. We'll be back again very soon with another episode of the Endless Sport Podcast. See you there. Thanks, Andrea.